Media Focus with Paul Blanchard.
This week, Free Sheets. Dennis Publishing has launched its first freemium magazine, Coach. But will more magazines go free in the future? Contributor networks. Blogging sites like the Huffington Post are attracting criticism for crowding out professional journalism. But are these websites actually an opportunity for freelancers? And ad blocking. For the first time, Apple has allowed ad blockers in its App Store. But do they pose a threat to journalism? And joining us as usual are two of the media's best and brightest. Ed Needham is editor at Coach, and Serena Bergman is head of content and community at the News Hub.
Media Focus.
So first up, Dennis Publishing has launched its first ever so-called freemium magazine called Coach. Aimed at men who want to make themselves healthier and fitter, it debuted with a print circulation of 300,000, with two-thirds being handed out in cities around the UK. Since the relaunch of the Evening Standard in 2009, lots of publishers have looked at launching so-called freemium mags, with premium content that are funded almost exclusively from advertising. Ed, tell us more about Coach, and do you think more magazines will go free in this way in the future?
Well, Coach, we launched just last week after about a year's preparation, thinking very much, I suppose the germ of the idea was, is there an opportunity to do a health and fitness weekly? And the more we looked at it, the more we realised that, in fact, you know, the when men think of health and fitness weekly, the archetype is very much as something with a shirtless man displaying his six-pack, and the route to that is to go obsessively to the gym, get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, think about nothing else. And we very quickly became apparent as we studied this that, in fact, most men don't think like that. You know, their approach to health and fitness doesn't actually involve ultimately looking like David Beckham, but their motivation is unique to everybody. It's what we describe as everyone has their fitness fingerprint. So, you know, maybe some people want to lose a bit of weight because they've got to go to a wedding. Maybe some people want to turn their lives around because they've been drinking too much. Maybe somebody's just started a new relationship. There are as many reasons as there are, you know, men in the country. And so we started to then think about, well, how do we put this together to, you know, meet those guys' needs? And there are a couple of groups, really. There's the younger guys, the younger group, who are sort of mid-20s to mid-30s, anything younger than that. And I think men can kind of do whatever they want. Health and fitness is, you know, they can run around as much as they like, drink as much as they like, and eat whatever they want, never put an ounce on, this kind of thing. When they get into mid-20s, mid-30s, in the mid-20s to mid-30s, one group that, you know, we did a lot of focus groups, and these guys are hugely enthusiastic. They feel very much that life is ahead of them, and they're wanting to try new things, plenty of disposable income or a bit of disposable income for the first time in their lives, and really, you know, looking ahead to stuff, massively open-minded. And second group, mid-30s to mid-40s, when they came in after the younger guys in the focus groups, I almost fell off my chair, because these guys, the difference was immense. You know, they certainly didn't feel that life was in front of them. They felt life was very much staring them in the face. You know, it's a set of, rather than a series of opportunities, it was a set of problems, you know, money problems, think about the family, think about the job, think about the career, think about the mortgage. Very stressful, tended to have a longer commute because they lived a bit further out. And so they had a lot more time, you know, to think about, you know, the what the day held.
You're describing me to a T so far. Well, carry on.
This, you know, this is one of the reasons why we're so confident the Coach is going to be successful, because you really don't have to look very far beneath the surface or you know, scratch the surface with any, you know, man you could stop in the street and say, look, you know, we know you want to do something. And that's the tagline of Coach: do something. You want to do something to get your life heading in a slightly different direction, or to improve it a little bit, or lose a little bit of weight, or feel better about yourself. And so this is really where the sort of confidence about Coach comes from, that we believe there's, you know, one option for men is to go to the gym and you know, desperately try and assemble this six pack. But there are many, many other options as well. And it's all those other options that we're looking to cater for in Coach. So it's very encouraging, very much about motivation and inspiration. It's very friendly and gentle. We're not the kind of coach that screams at you from 6 millimeters away.
Do more.
You're not going to get spittle flecked, you know, from our language. It's very much, here's something that someone else has tried and succeeded. Perhaps you might want to have a go at that. And it's fun, you know, it's warm and entertaining. It's very much produced for men on their way into work or on their way home from work or sitting down at lunch. You may only be reading it for one stop. You know, you may be facing some of the many problems that people encounter on the tube, you know, of someone with the music too loud, of someone opening up the Financial Times, like, you know, putting a tent up in a gale, all these kind of vexations that people face in the morning. And so it's designed to be, you know, friendly, easygoing, and just kind of gently motivational. As to your question as to whether there is room for any more magazines, you know, I'm certainly hugely confident that we've found a big market here. We've found the tone. We've got the brand right. But there are only so many days in the week.
Mm.
And a big part of free magazines is obviously distribution. And there's a point in the future when there aren't going to be any more days left for people to distribute on. So how much can you double up? You know, can tube stations or mainline railway stations cope with 2, 3, 4 magazines being distributed before customers start to, you know, commuters start to think, actually, I pass, you know, you're getting on my nerves now.
Mm.
And obviously, there's never going to be a situation where there's an entire news agent's worth of free magazines being given out every day. So there is a limit there somewhere. But at the moment, I feel, you know, this is still, you know, we've done the sums and everybody has to do those sums. You have to work out what your probable costs are and what your possible revenues are. And if those numbers are in alignment, then there's a business opportunity. And so we feel very much that here, you know, there's a day. Wednesday is coach day. There's a business plan and there's an entire experienced publishing company behind it, Dennis Publishing. You know, these aren't newcomers. These are massively experienced in producing weekly magazines and magazines for men. So, you know, confidence is immense, but whether that opportunity can be easily replicated by other companies, I feel the door is starting to close a little bit, just because there's limited physical space and there are only so many days in the week.
Serena, do you think that freemium magazines are the way forward?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I think for me, anything which is print first, I struggle a little bit with internally because of my background in digital journalism. I have looked at the website. I think it's fantastic content. I think everything always has to stand on the back of the quality of its content. But I think with free publications, it's quite interesting if you look at kind of the launch of Shortlist and Stylist around about the same time that the Evening Standard went free. And you look at kind of this era as the sort of 2008, 2010 kind of gap, which was sort of slightly before the mainstream had access to, you know, 3G, 4G, iPhones, iPads, so on, constant access to all the content on all the trains throughout their commute. And I think people have built up awareness and a bit of a bond with those brands now, which is what makes them keep picking it up. I think launching something now is incredibly courageous on the basis simply that people do have constant access to the internet and constant ability to kind of download articles to read, which I know I do, and a lot of people that I speak to is what they do for the tube journeys and so on. But I think, you know, it's definitely a really interesting model. I think it's definitely more sustainable than trying to get people to pay for content. People don't believe that they should pay for content anymore in the same way. I don't know whether perhaps giving something away for free that people have associated at a relatively high cost, which is a weekly magazine, whether that perhaps diminishes the perception of quality, wrongly, in my opinion, but it could be. But that's something, I suppose, for marketers to work on. I think it'll always stand on the quality of the journalism, and so far the first issue looks fantastic.
Ed, you've obviously edited magazines that people have bought, you know, famously FHM in the UK and in the US as well. Is it a different challenge for you as an editor? Do you have to be mindful of the fact that this is a freemium sheet? Or is the challenge for you as an editor exactly the same as whether someone would pay £2 or whether it be advertising subsidised but handed out for free in terms of editorial?
I think there are minor differences, but I think all journalism is essentially the same in that, in my opinion, you know, you have to tell people something they didn't know and you have to make it interesting. And everything is a version of that. And there's a kind of third caveat, which is you have to be accurate. But I think, I know the Americans would disagree with me, but that tends to come secondary to, you know, the need to tell people something they didn't know and to be interesting in the telling of it. So whether people are paying for it or whether you get it for free, you've got to kind of ring both bells. And I also think, you know, there's something about the paid model. Certainly with men, with health and fitness magazines, we found, you know, with talking to guys, that for them to hand over money and to be seen reading magazines which they paid for, very much felt that they were being judged about those magazines. It's like, you know, to be seen reading a title says something about you if you've paid for that title, you've invested your money in it. And so certain men, you know, they would say with Men's Health, they didn't feel they could be seen reading Men's Health in public because they felt that people would be judging them and judging them negatively, saying, well, that magazine's not for you. You know,
well, yeah, because the guy in the front's got abs of steel, whereas you've got a tiny pot belly.
And here's you carrying a bit of timber. Yeah, you know, it's just wrong. Whereas with a free magazine, that judgment doesn't take place. You know, you could have picked it up for all sorts of reasons. You've not invested your money in it. And so from that perspective, it makes editing the magazine a lot easier. But always, you know, the content has got to be of a quality. It has to be appropriate to the market, to the reader, to anyone who might pick it up. You know, it can't be, you know, this is a long way away from the old men's magazine school of publishing of a girl on the cover and a fairly cynical approach to the topics of the day and, you know, a little bit rude and cheeky, you know, and perhaps not the kind of thing you'd want to end up in a child's hands, for example, whereas Coach is very much, you know, we're of a level of sort of sophistication or at least friendliness that, you know, there's nothing to be, that no one's going to be anyway kind of intimidated or embarrassed by what they're reading. But in terms of editing, no, it's an absolute pleasure to edit. I think there's a whole world of material here to, you know, it's the more we think about the world of health and fitness and mental well-being and people wanting to be happier and deal with the stresses and anxieties that they face, you know, there is absolutely limitless roster of material that we can deal with.
Serena, do you think there are gender differences here? I mean, because, you know, the female market is well catered for with, like, Stylist magazine and so on, but I know it's a kind of meme on the internet and a cliche of criticising women's magazines, but do you think there is some truth to this whole thing, this duality of women's magazines, where they say, first of all, find a man who loves you for who you are, but secondly, here's how to lose 20 pounds?
Possibly, yes. I think women's magazines are improving tremendously. Some of them still try to batter those ideas into our heads, which is incredibly frustrating. You know, everyone might have seen a few weeks ago Glamour had a bit of an accident on that front, and I think it was how to make a man happy or something like that. It went viral. The internet decided that it was outrageous, which it rightly was, and it disappeared from the website, which was fantastic. I think more interestingly, because, you know, this has been talked about to death, is perhaps the idea that magazines are for women. So when you open a Saturday or a Sunday paper, you'll see that the actual newspaper and the features in the actual newspaper are geared towards men, even though the topics are very much sort of broad and non-gender specific. Whereas if you open a magazine in a Sunday or a Saturday paper, you'll see that all of the food, for example, is geared towards a woman. The article is aimed towards women. There's a lot of women's fashion. There's a lot of kind of issues that are considered female. And that is a perception that women read magazines, men read newspapers. And I'm really excited by the fact that, you know, this kind of reputational idea can be challenged by free magazines, because actually, you know, in my household, my mum would read the paper and my stepdad would read the magazine, and that was absolutely fine.
Ed, what's your view? Do you think that gender-specific magazines are on the way out, as well as you know, all the plethora of different routes to market in terms of freemium subscription, etc., etc.? Do you think that there's more flux than we originally thought?
It's still with the difficult questions. I mean, I don't know. I mean, obviously, Coach is aimed at men. It's aimed at men, you know, for editorial reasons, but also for advertising reasons. You know, it's a big part of the thinking is how do we provide an interesting platform, you know, for the kind of advertisers who don't reach as many men as they would like to. I certainly agree, you know, that there is something a bit, you know, bonkers about some of the, you know, the approach to women's magazines traditionally. You know, five steps to eternal happiness is, you know, this constant overpromising I think people must have seen through it by now.
It's definitely six steps. For them to misrepresent it as five is just wrong.
And Coach, you know, even though it's for men, you know, the idea is that, you know, we want women to enjoy it just as much. You know, it's perhaps gender specific to an extent, but, you know, that certainly the tone, the...
can be enjoyed by all.
Absolutely. You know, it's certainly not designed to somehow be exclusive or turn anybody away. It's absolutely welcoming.
Do you think all hell's going to break loose, though, in the magazine industry per se? I mean, I was at the PPA Awards dinner a few weeks ago, and it just struck me of the kind of plurality of different routes to market now. So you've got freemium magazines like yourself. You've got the traditional newsstand magazines that are after the subscriptions. But I subscribe to an app called Readly, for example. There are quite a few out there. I pay $9.99 a month. It's a bit like Spotify, but for magazines. And, I mean, the Economist isn't on it, and a few, you know, big kind of titles, but a large amount of the magazines that I subscribe to are on it. And it got to a point where Empire's on it, and I'm a big Empire reader. Why do I need to subscribe to it, though, if it's on Readly? In exactly the same way that one of my favourite bands brought out a new album a couple of weeks ago, but why do I need to buy it? Because it's on Spotify. So do you think that some magazines will always be paid for, kind of newsstand subscription model, others will kind of have a hybrid, and where do you think freemium fits in? So well, these are difficult questions. I'm glad you are answering that.
These are more essay questions. I mean, freemium fits in that, you know, this is a brand, you know, which is valuable content, which is being physically placed in people's hands. That's the key to it. You know, this isn't something which is left around for people to pick up. So there are a certain number of copies which are placed in, you know, health clubs or similar. A magazine which is placed in people's hands is given to people. You know, so obviously people have to like the cover, or they have to feel familiar with the title, or, you know, sufficiently happy with the combination of colours or whatever it is, that the smile of the person who gives them the magazine. But there is a part of the distribution process. Nobody else is, you know, there is no other placing of physical content in people's hands in the magazine industry. Obviously, internet has done its damnedest to, you know, wreak merry hell on the magazine industry. And it's kind of to the magazine industry's credit that it is kind of withstood pretty well. You know, there are a huge number of magazines available. There's still a thriving business. And I guess you just have to decide, you know, which is your platform now. It's moved beyond the, you know, whether you want the physical product or the digital version.
But do you think the magazines won't see the kind of subscription levels and newsstand sales that they used to enjoy traditionally?
Who knows? Well, there's so many things remain to be seen, you know. But if we were having this conversation even 5 years ago, you know, we would have been, you know, in a completely different world. You know, things change massively quickly. The development of digital world has probably changed just in the 20 minutes we've been sat having this conversation. So who knows? All you can do is respond to the present and trust, you know, what you've learned from the past, and use the experience of people and the knowledge of people, the instincts, and have a little bit of faith. And, you know, work on that basis. It's the same with any business. You know, I've launched a business 7 or 8 years ago. You make a business plan. By the time even you get from the point of printing the business plan between then and going to market, everything has changed. So, you know, there's a great deal of this is just trusting your own instinct, having trust in your judgment, and feeling that you have a certain affinity with the people who will ultimately be reading the title.
So next up, online contributor networks like the Huffington Post and the News Hub have grown rapidly over the last few years. Many journalists say these sites threaten the industry because they don't pay their writers or give them a proportion of the profits, and a large number of their contributors don't have backgrounds in professional journalism. In response, these sites point out that many of their contributors are actually freelancers who generate a lot of supplementary income through these blogs. Serena, are these contributor networks a threat or an opportunity?
Well, I think the key question is, a threat or an opportunity to whom? The perception that there's one type of person that's a professional journalist and everyone else is something different is completely bizarre to me. I think, you know, what makes you a journalist? If you're a blogger who's generating a huge amount of income from advertising because people want to read your blog, you're earning a living from writing, does that make you a journalist? Or what if, like you said, you know, you're a journalist who writes for very little income or no money for, you know, The Guardian or Forbes or The New York Times, and they're really well-respected publications, then are you a journalist? Are you not?
Well, The Guardian's been hemorrhaging millions for years anyway. It's only supported by the Scotch Trust. Are they a newspaper?
Well, quite. So I think that there's no real distinction there. I think really what we have to think about is it a benefit to society? And I think when you look at it in that way, there's no denying that it is. I think the internet has given us, it seems odd to talk about the internet as a thing even anymore, just life, has given us the opportunity now to access so much different content, and it's done great things. We're talking just now about women's magazines, and I think, you know, women's magazines used to be so horrendously misogynistic and just pushing the same rhetoric over and over again. And, you know, then you had blogs like Vagenda, Feministing, Jezebel that popped up between sort of 2008 to 2010, that kind of era, maybe earlier. And then they just sort of changed the whole rhetoric around women's magazines and paved the way for things like The Debrief, which is owned by Bauer, which is a fantastic women's publication online, and The Pool and so on. And I think that was created by people at home starting blogs, which then became really popular. So I think it's very difficult to say that any kind of great content on the internet is a threat. I think people probably buy less encyclopedias now because of Wikipedia, but no one would say that having that information out there democratised is a bad thing. And I like to think about journalism in the same way. In terms of paying for content, the way the News Hub works is we'll let anyone publish as long as their writing is up to scratch. So we do have a look and make sure that they can write. Once they have a code and they're able to publish, they can write whatever they want, whenever they want, as often or as rare as they like. They can post features, comment, breaking news, whatever they want. We are just a platform for them to write on. We do pay for content, which is what makes us different. Usually with platforms, if you're posting on your own blog or you're posting on somewhere like Medium, for example, or Huffington Post, as you mentioned, you don't get paid at all. You're forfeiting any right to make any money on that. And it has other benefits, but you are not going to make any money from it. And we think
I write for the Huffington Post, and like you say, I don't get paid, but
so
they're side benefits, aren't they?
Exactly. And I completely understand that. And another thing that we do is, you know, we publish under Creative Commons licenses. So if you write for us, you own your content. If you then want to sell it elsewhere, you can take it elsewhere. You can put it on your blog. You can do whatever you want with it. And that's to give writers complete and utter freedom. And it allows us to have voices appear on the News Hub, which you don't see elsewhere. Because if you are trying to create a platform that's exclusively driving traffic, and you know this as an editor, Ed, we all know this, you want to create content that's going to make people buy your publication or come back to your website. And you're not going to commission stuff that you think isn't going to resonate with your readers, regardless of how kind of politically or socially important it may be. We've had some fantastic content from all kinds of areas in the world, from Yemen, from France, throughout Charlie Hebdo, very sort of controversial political opinions, both on the far left and the far right. We let it go up, and some of them do really well, which proves that there is an appetite for this. It's democratizing the amount of information and the amount of opinions that people can see. And obviously, we can't pay for all the content because we're not commissioning it. So a lot of our, in fact, 90% of our content doesn't get paid because it's not generating that traffic. So it's not really valuable to us, but the content that is valuable, that people do want to read, we think it's really important to reward. And we've created a payment system, which I won't go into in too much detail now, but we do believe that it rewards the best content. And anecdotally, that's what it seems to do. And I struggle to see how that can be a threat, really, to anyone who believes in democratic journalism, openness of information, and the ability to, you know, both earn money from a publisher and to be able to pay contributors.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the News Hub for those that are new to it?
Absolutely.
Like, who funds it? What's the genesis of it? Who's behind it? Who's the team, etc.?
Yeah, so the CEO is called Will. He's my boss. He's fantastic. He came up with the idea. We've been live for just over a year now. And the idea behind it was, you know, journalism in its current format, most people would agree, isn't quite sustainable. You have situations where either people aren't getting paid for their content, or, as you said, you know, publications are hemorrhaging money because they can't make it back on advertising. So the idea behind it was to create a platform where, on the one hand, it's an open market for people to be able to create content and have a community around them. Because something which is fantastic, I work a lot with, we have sort of everyone from professional journalists to students to CEOs and anyone who wants to write for us. And they'll come, and if they want to, we'll help them work on their writing, and we'll say, this is what I would do for a headline. This is where I think you should source a picture. This is the kind of angle that might improve, you know, your ability to market it throughout social media and whatnot. So that gives people a really helpful opportunity, which they wouldn't get necessarily if they were just blogging on their own. Things like Huffington Post, you know yourself, they vet the content. You can't just go there and post. You have to write something that is of a certain standard, which their editors think fit with the voice of the publication.
Can't be too self-promotional. I mean, I've only had one blog post rejected in 3 years, which I'm quite proud of. But again, that went on a little bit too much about my business rather than, you know, talking about the business generally.
I mean, obviously, we have safeguards there because we make revenue from advertising, so we don't allow people to be too promotional. But I'm thinking more sort of if things perhaps jar with the tone of a publication. In that sense, it would be quite difficult to get it published. And same on BuzzFeed, they have a community section. You can't just publish, you know, the kind of essay that you might put on Huffington Post or this kind of list and vice versa. So it's basically somewhere where as long as you can write whatever you want, which is great for the people who are posting content. And, you know, we've got over 1,000 contributors in 45 countries now. We've only been going for a year, so that's fantastic. And then from a sort of consumer side, we're offering a kind of completely open approach where as a reader, you can read content from all sides of the globe, right? Really, like anywhere, any kind of content you want to read. You can select categories, so you can tailor your feed to whatever it is you want to see. You can follow people so that you can read everything that they write or ignore people that you don't want to see. So it's a really kind of tailored experience. So we hope that it's providing a really, really good service to both sides.
Ed, are people like Serena and Adriana Huffington two of the kind of four horsemen of the traditional journalism apocalypse?
Well,
I thought that was very good, by the way. I'm very gutted that there wasn't a response. But please carry on.
I think the real threat to journalism is kind of much bigger than that. Other individuals, you know, have come up with platforms that kind of take advantage of journalists' desperation. You know, the malaise, I think, is much greater than this. You know, whereas few publications are now able to properly fund real journalism. Now, Serena's kind of made the point, you know, what is real journalism? You know, everybody has the right to, you know, publish what they want, to produce, if they write on any topic.
But can you earn a living from it?
Blog about. Quite. And so, you know, things, you know, big, major topics nowadays that newspapers really struggle to cover, like, for example, say, child trafficking. You know, it's something that you have to put a journalist on for a significant period of time in order to make the contents and see what happens, to follow people, to really get into the subject, in order to write something genuinely useful and informative. And newspapers and news organisations don't have the money for that anymore because of the economics of the business at the moment. So that's kind of where I think the real threat to big stories lies. I have to say, you know, in with the sort of advent of these, you know, companies such as yours, Serena, and Huffington Post, you don't ever hear journalists saying, this is fantastic, I get such a good deal out of these people. So for all the, you know, enthusiasm about democratizing journalism, and, you know, obviously Arianna Huffington's done very nicely for herself, I don't really see journalists thinking, wow, this is so much better than things used to be. It does kind of boil down to the content. You know, if you can't attract enough people to write interesting stories, again, it's fantastic being able to tailor your experience. But if there's nothing on there that you want, then ultimately people aren't going to come, and quality will out. In as regards journalism, now, I don't want to include, you know, sort of the sort of bloggers that, say, my 11-year-old daughter absolutely delights in watching, and who have managed to craft, multi-million pound careers for themselves, and, you know, hats off to them. But when it comes down to journalism, the production of stories that are not in the public domain, that are difficult to get, that have to be tailored in a particular way, I fail to see how the free, you know, have a go, see how you get on model really services the world of journalism in that way.
Can I just respond to that? I get a lot of journalists saying, this is fantastic, it's so much better than it used to be. And there's a number of, and I say that I get that coming from seasoned journalists who think it's a really, don't get me wrong, I also get people saying, this is horrendous, you're going to kill journalism, you're the worst thing that's ever happened. But there are people, journalists for example, who have stories that they know they can't pitch to traditional editors, but they want to post somewhere. There's nowhere for it to go. It can go up on their blog, but perhaps they don't have a huge social media presence, they don't think they'll get anything out of it. I have students who don't know how to pitch. I mean, you'd be amazed by some of the pitches that appear in my inbox that if I worked at any other publication, I would never respond to. They'd be laughed out of the building. And we do respond to them, and they say, gosh, this is amazing that we have this opportunity. And some of those people probably will go on to work on the kind of journalism that I think, Ed, you consider to be the kind of journalism that perhaps we're letting slide.
But that's, I think that's always been the case, though. You know, people want to have a go, have always been able to have a go. There have always been, you know, opportunities, whether that's, you know, apprenticeships or doing work experience or sending pieces in, you know, on spec. You know, I started very late in journalism. I was 30 before I kind of really sort of started to having a go at it. It just involved sending ideas to people I'd never met before. And eventually I sort of managed to get just a toe in the door. So if people want to, they've always been able to try. I don't think this necessarily gives people, you know, I don't think it widens anything up. People have always had a go, but I'm just interested to hear why journalists have said this is so much better than it used to be. What's better than it used to be?
Okay, so in terms of just what you said about the opportunities that are there, I don't think that it's in any way the same thing. I think, yes, you can send something into an office on spec, but when you only have so many pages in a newspaper and that's as far as it goes, your chances of getting in there are very minimal. Yes, you can go and do internships and work experience, but there's huge competition and they're very geared towards people of a certain background and a certain standing. And, you know, I did loads of internships, which I wouldn't have been able to do if I didn't live in London. I didn't have, you know, a family and friends that could help me out there. So I don't think it's fair to say that that's an equivalent. I think in terms
of... So is this a kind of stepping stone then, as it were, that you can, in order to get a more traditional job later on, you can build up a body of work on sites like the News Hub and Huffington Post?
That's certainly part of it. There's certainly lots of students and lots of people who want to move into journalism that use it in that way, and I think that's fantastic. And that's certainly part of what I did when I was at university. But I think in terms of your question, Ed, about why journalists think that this is an opportunity that's really improving things for journalists. And I think the reason for that is, like I mentioned, that obviously people who work for publications often aren't allowed to freelance. So I'm going to take them out of the equation because they don't tend to write for us if they're on staff. But for example, freelancers who write for big newspapers, traditional publications, and also write for us, what they find that they can do is they're not pandering to an editor in the same way. So they don't need to get something commissioned, accepted, written, subbed, edited by an editor, sent back for edits, and then before it's even live, if it even goes live. They don't have any of those problems. They can write whatever they want. Mm. Agreed that perhaps there's a quality issue there, and I accept that that's true. But
right, there's a good reason why those processes exist. You know, they're not
to be paid
for people's amusement.
Of course, and I absolutely think that they should exist. Absolutely, 100%. But I think that there are places where they shouldn't be necessary. And I think that there's a benefit to having platforms where you don't have to have those processes because they do get in the way. And I think if you look at certain platforms that often people say are sort of killing journalism or the worst possible side of journalism, like BuzzFeed or like Vice or publications like that, they're also the publications that are doing fantastic work in original, investigative, long-form journalism. If you look at Vice documentaries, they're incredible. If you look at BuzzFeed's long-form journalism, it's really pushing out issues that aren't published anywhere else. So I think often sometimes you do have to fund that kind of journalism, and it's always been the way, you know, fund that kind of journalism with perhaps a more easily accessible journalism, which more people can do. And I don't see that necessarily giving more options for people to post on is going to in any way damage that.
So how much would I earn if I came and wrote a piece for you, for example?
That completely depends. So at the moment, we've been increasing our fees since we launched, and we continue to increase them. At the moment, each article in the top 10% of a category will earn $50 as a flat fee. However, we are looking at stratifying that, but we haven't done so yet.
So if I got in the top 10%, I could expect about 35 quid
for each article. So we have people who have dozens of pieces in the top 10%. And you're only competing against other content within the category. So a celebrity piece would never compete with a political piece. In addition, we also pay a bonus that's based around people who publish a huge volume of content, but maybe can't quite get up there. We get sort of the top people in each parent category, so news, life and sport, will get paid $150 in addition to anything they make from their individual
stories. Is it not horses for courses, Ed, insofar as, you know, I hope they don't throw me off for saying this, but a lot of the Huffington Post content is variable. I think one of their fantastic writers is me. But there are other people who I wouldn't read, and then there are those that I happen upon where I think, well, I don't think this would actually be found elsewhere, but I'm glad I read it. So, you know, but on the other hand, if I go to, you know, read Coach magazine, I expect a certain standard. I expect the journalist, you know, a consistent tone in terms of quality as well, and I also expect the journalists to have earned enough money to pay their rent and buy their porridge.
Quite. I mean, there's a couple of other things. You know, one is it kind of bothers me that there's not that everything digital always falls down when there's not a person involved at a key stage. So, for example, with Uber, my first experience of Uber was fantastic. I thought this is great. It's quick. It's cheap. It's efficient. My second experience of Uber was disastrous. Because my friend left her phone in the back of the car and it was impossible to get it back. And the driver, who we found after many, many phone calls to that phone, the driver said, I'll give it back to you if you give me 50 quid. And though it was impossible to...
Surely that's theft. He can't do that. It's not hypocrisy.
It's all sorts of things. But she just wanted to get her phone back. But because there wasn't a person in an intermediary to say, look, we've got this problem, she couldn't get it back until she said, look, I work for the Daily Mail. You don't get that phone back. Wait and see what happens. The phone came back in an hour's time.
Oh, that's
almost on a velvet cushion.
Absolutely. That's why I want to work for the Daily Mail.
It's the same, I think, with... You know, with everything, where a person is required at a key stage and they're not there, if it's just automated, then problems, ensue. And I think that's, you kind of see that a little bit here.
How does it work then, Serena, in terms of you do check everything, don't you? Or is it that once someone passes that quality threshold, you then let them get on with it? Because I submit to the Huffington Post, but they do still read my submissions, and 99% of the time it gets authorised. But, literally the odd one, they do reject.
Yeah, they read your submissions and they also tweak it very often. And sometimes they'll add a picture, though often not, which really annoys me about the Huffington Post. So we allow people to post having read one piece of content from them. So they'll submit a piece, it'll come through to us. I have to say, it's not that automated. We have a personal relationship with our contributors, or the majority of our contributors. So they'll come through with a piece and it'll come through and we'll take a look at it. And if it's good, we click authorize and they can post whatever they want. However, we're reading the site. So if we see issues with something, we'll deal with it. It's not like we just sort of let it go. That said, eventually perhaps there will come a time where that has to happen, but we have a trending algorithm, which means that the content that's used the most gets to the top. So the idea is that the really rubbish content is never seen by anyone, which is a similar kind of idea to what Medium tried to do. So that's kind of the idea behind that. I think the issue with Uber, there are lots of issues with Uber, obviously, but people use it because it's cheap, and it is cheap. And that's why people have these problems and they continue to use Uber. Now, you can use Uber and you're forfeiting perhaps your moral high ground in a pub debate, and you're forfeiting perhaps the ability to have good customer service, some sort of safety, some sort of guarantee. And people do that because it's cheap. And I don't think that can really be pushed into any kind of other area, and certainly not into journalism. But I think my point is that you get some benefits, and then if something goes wrong, then occasionally, there'll be a price to pay for that.
Quite. I mean, my argument obviously isn't against Uber. It's against the, employing technology to do the job of a person where, an individual skill or individual context is required. So an example of that, I have a copy of your homepage here printed out in my old-fashioned style. And one of the stories, one of the top stories this morning, is headlined Disenfranchised. And if I came to this as I did, I wouldn't have the faintest idea what that story was about. So if I were editing that, I'd say, well, look, this headline's just not acceptable, because I have no idea what you're telling me here. And especially in the nanosecond span of attention that people apply to digital everything, if I just saw the word disenfranchised, I would not be tempted to read that story. So whereas if somebody, an individual, had taken the trouble to say, well, actually, we've got a fantastic story here, but that headline just isn't working. If you don't, if people don't read the first word, they're not going to read the second.
Who subs it is the question then. Did the article writer come up with that headline, or did you guys?
The article writers create their own headlines. Absolutely, that's not a great headline from an editorial perspective. And we would have gone back to that writer and said, hi, great piece. That headline isn't going to do very well on site. You're probably not going to get...
So why didn't you?
We would have.
Well, this is from your site this morning.
Yeah, I'm explaining how the process works. So we'll go back, we'll say this headline isn't probably going to do very well. It's not going to get you into the top 10%. We suggest you change it. Here's a link to our suggestions for how to write a great headline. But if the writer doesn't want to change it, they have complete editorial freedom not to change it. And the price that they have to pay for that is that they probably will sink to the bottom of that feed really quickly. Very few people will see it and they won't get paid for it. And that's a shame if it's a good story, but it's their choice because they have complete editorial freedom. And we trust that our readers will also do what they have to do in order to ensure that the best content is at the top. And that's how we work.
Journalists are obviously skilled at writing, they develop their contacts, they've got their field of expertise and everything, and then to then have to learn, a whole set of skills, which are quite alien to journalists. The people get into journalism for all sorts of reasons, but there is a sort of, type whose imagination is sparked by stories and people, and it's not sparked by having to, learn about H1 headlines and, feeds and technical aspect of that comes with posting and having to promote your own work in a digital field. So it's a bit like, you know, you can be one of the most talented sort of journalists in the world, but you've also got to learn a skill which is completely alien to you. Like, it's almost like you have to, you know, suddenly learn how to repair agricultural machinery or something like this. They're two completely different skills. Now, obviously, journalists have to do this. They don't have an alternative anymore. But, you know, there is this inherent unfairness, I think, which sort of penalises journalists.
Can I just really quickly make the point that I completely understand that, I agree with that. I have often, you know, applied for jobs where they expect me to know how to create video content or know how to code, of which my knowledge is very limited, and I accept that frustration, which is why the News Hub isn't for everyone. Not every journalist will or should write for the News Hub. Not every publication should work in the way that the News Hub does, but I think that the people who do write for us and the people who do read the site do get a lot of benefits from the way that we work, and I think there's a space for it.
And finally, more users are choosing to install so-called ad blockers, which stop advertisements from appearing on the web. Apple recently, and controversially, allowed ad blockers into its App Store, opening it up to accusations that it was damaging news websites that were dependent on the advertisements to make money and therefore continue to exist. Possibly in response, Google has announced that it's working on AMP, Accelerated Mobile Pages, which will provide publishers with guidelines for creating less intrusive and quick-loading ads. The idea is that people are less likely to block ads if they don't interfere with their user experience. Ed, do you think this is wishful thinking on Google's part, or do you think ad blockers are a serious threat to the media?
Well, I think from the conversation that we've been having already, it's clear that, you know, journalism is indestructible. You know, journalists are... less indestructible, but journalism will survive, you know, whatever the scenario. Ad blockers, in a way, are fantastic news for ink on paper magazines. You know, there's advertisers love print. You know, there is of all the platforms that adverts can appear on, the printed advert is the most desirable. It's the most liked by readers. It's the most, has the most impact. It lasts. People like the way it feels. Whereas, obviously, you know, advertising online has a very checkered past. You know, I think something like 1 in 1,000 ad banners are now opened, and every other one of those is opened by accident. You know, it doesn't particularly work. So
there's this thing called banner blindness as well, isn't there, where they've studied people with pupil trackers, and they actually never, they subconsciously can see the areas of the screen where they know there's an advert, and therefore they don't even look at it.
People subconsciously tune them out. Exactly. So there's long been the need for advertisers to work out more effective ways of talking to users. But I kind of think if the parameters are these, that the companies have to market their products, that billions of people are on the internet or other sort of digital arenas and are potential customers, and that some of the biggest and most powerful digital players make their billions from advertising, Google, Facebook, Twitter, the rest, then this problem will be solved. Ad blockers are likely to be a blip rather than a serious, you know, story. And within 6 months, the internet will have worked out a way to sidestep this problem, and advertisers will have worked out better ways to communicate their, you know, the benefits of their products to their customers.
Serena, do you think that this is a problem? Because as a user, you want as few ads as possible, really. But as someone who would have a website dependent on advertising revenue, the last thing you want is your readers to install an ad blocker.
My personal opinion is that I really, really hope that ad blockers kill display advertising in journalism. I think it's absolutely bonkers. I think the stat about people, you know, 1 in 1,000, if that, that's optimistic. I read stats that said you're more likely to survive a plane crash or win the lottery than you are to intentionally click on a display ad. It's a model of advertising where it feels like publishers are trying to con people into seeing this content that they don't want to see, and trying to con brands into believing that paying them loads of money to put it there will work. It's completely different to print advertising. Print advertising has a long history of being incredibly creative, of being something which people interact with, which has, you know, clear results. And people just decided to put these ads in sort of billboard fashion on a website, and it just doesn't work. I hope that these ad blockers really do take off. I think there's proof in the fact that brands know that their customers use them and let them use them. For example, 4OD is the only one that I can think of. I actually don't have ad blockers on myself, but that's sort of perhaps a professional thing. But 4OD, for example, is the only website that I can think of that actively says to you, you have ad blocker on, so we're not going to show you the content you want to see. I've never seen any other website do that. They all must know that we have ad blockers on and just let us get on with it because they know that people don't want to see those ads. Now, what's the answer? Native advertising, sponsored content, absolutely 100%. It's the way that journalism should be funded. It gives a benefit to the reader. It's providing content that people are interested in or engaged with. And it's giving brands the opportunity to speak directly to the people that are going to buy their products.
Well, we're out of metaphorical tip there, guys. So, Ed, let me throw to you first. Tell us a bit more about Coach. How can people read it online? How can they read it physically as well? What tube station should they be at to get it? When's it come out? How do people follow it?
Coachmag.co.uk is the web address. It's a pretty, formidable project of its own. You know, it has a large staff. It's edited by a very talented editor, Joe Barnes, who used to edit FHM. He has his own staff. It takes a certain amount of content from the magazine, but it's a daily, there's not much point in just putting a magazine on the website each week. It has a daily supply of fresh content. And for people looking for the actual magazine itself, it's available at all good tube stations and a significant number of kind of suburban and outer London stations every Wednesday. And that's Wednesday morning, evening, and in a few London locations lunchtime, like Oxford Circus, for example. Well, you can also get it on Wednesday lunchtimes.
Serena, how do people follow the News Hub and how do people follow you personally on Twitter? This is the chance to self-promote.
Oh, how exciting. You can go to the News Hub, we're the-newshub.com. From there you can read our content, follow your favourite writers, select your favourite categories and 100% apply to write for us. You can also follow us on Twitter at The News Hub. You can follow me personally at Serena Bergman. I also blog at serenabergman.com.
For those that want to follow me, I'm at Paul W.R. Blanchard. You can also go to the Media Focus website, mediafocus.org.uk, and leave your email address in the box and receive a shiny update email once a fortnight letting you know when the new podcast is out. And you can also follow Media Focus on Twitter at @media_focus_UK, where you can find breaking media news curated by Hannah Thompson. But that's it for now. I'm Paul Blanchard. The associate producer was Jordan Greenaway. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.
A Big Things Media production.